2. HMS Destiny, 54, off Terrence Point, Gulf of Matthias, and the Duke of Coleman's office, City of Ithria, Desnarian Empire. Sir Duncan Yearley had always hoped to someday fly his own Admiral Streamer. He hadn't expected it to come quite this soon, however, or under precisely these circumstances. He stood on HMS Destiny's quarterdeck, gazing up at that striped strip of steel thistle silk flying from his ship's foremast, and wondered exactly what the watchers ashore were making of his current antics. He turned his gaze aft. 26 galleons followed in Destiny's wake, each in the severe livery of the Imperial Carisian Navy. Other fleets, other navies, painted their ships in gaudy colors, decorated them with gold leaf and ornate carvings. Carisian warships were painted in black, the only color they boasted, the white stripes, marking the lines of their gun ports, and the red-painted lids of the ports themselves. In its own way, it was the most arrogant decoration available, Yearley thought. First, because the Empire was the only navy which painted its ships in that fashion, which made them instantly recognizable at any range. And secondly, because it was a statement that Carisian seamen needed no ornamentation to overawe any foe. Despite the severity of their paint scheme, the ships forging along behind him made a brave show, although it was obvious to any observer that he had rather more of the Imperial Navy's refitted merchantmen than he might have chosen. On the other hand, he turned his head, gazing out at the second column of mastheads paralleling his own. A trio of schooners lay between his own column and those distant masts to relay his signals, and he'd kept young Ensign Aplin Armok occupied for the past several hours, reporting his observations to them. More schooners slid smoothly through the water between him and Terrence Point, and others hovered farther to the northwest, covering the waters between Terrence Point and Howard Island. With the light breeze blowing almost directly into the Howard Passage from the Gulf, the schooner's speed and ability to work to windward made them ideal for keeping an eye peeled for the Imperial Desnarian Navy. Assuming, of course, that the Imperial Desnarian Navy felt adventurous enough to poke its collective nose out of its snug little hidey hole in the Gulf of Jaris, when so much of the Imperial Carisian Navy was obviously waiting, longingly, for it to do precisely that. "Oh, crap," the Desnarian Army Lieutenant, in charge of the observation post on the tip of Terrence Point, muttered quietly, but with great feeling, as he bent to peer through the tripod-mounted telescope at the apparently endless column of Carisian ships. "See what I mean, sir?" his sergeant asked respectfully. "I do indeed, sergeant," the lieutenant acknowledged, straightening his back and glaring out to sea. "What I don't see is what kind of bee got up their arses for them to suddenly be doing this kind of shit." He stood glowering at the Carisians, then sighed. "Well, I suppose we'd better get the message off."
"And so yet another brilliant strategy goes astray," the Duke of Coleman murmured, gazing at the transcript of the semaphore message from the Terrence Point observation post. He shook his head, then laid the transcript on his desk, very carefully and precisely, and looked at Baron Jaris.
"You know," he said almost whimsically, "I don't know how much Caleb Armok pays his spies, but it obviously isn't enough. They must have known about our instructions almost as soon as we did."
"Not necessarily," Jaris disagreed. The Duke frowned and Jaris chuckled sourly. "Oh, I agree they know what's going on, but they could have found out as much as a 5 day or more after we did and still managed to arrange this."
He flicked an index finger at the sheet of paper on Coleman's desk.
"You're right about another brilliant plan going straight into the crapper, though," he continued. "And it's obviously another case of Vicar Elaine getting too clever for his own good. I can understand why he didn't want us sailing prematurely.
But the way it's worked out, we're screwed, at least until, and unless, Harper and Shao get close enough to threaten these people from the north.
That's not precisely what we're supposed to be doing, the Duke observed, and Jarrus shrugged.
Tell me something I don't know, Diven. I'm not too clear on exactly how we're supposed to follow the plan, though. They haven't put anything heavier than schooners and 3 or 4 galleons into our coastal waters for months now. Though I don't doubt they've had more ships farther out to sea, ready to whistle up if we'd been foolish enough to come out. But they've obviously been relying on a distant blockade strategy. They didn't want to keep us sealed in port. They wanted to draw us out, where they could pounce on us in deep water, which is precisely why I had no intention at all of going there. Now, suddenly, they've got the next best thing to 30 galleons trailing their coats less than 15 miles offshore. And there are more of the bastards farther out to sea. I'd say it's pretty obvious they know we've been ordered to sortie, and they don't plan on us doing anything of the sort.
The Captain General's orders aren't exactly discretionary, Irwin, Coleman pointed out.
Oh, yes, they are, Jarrus demurred. Coleman arched an eyebrow, and the Baron snorted. They say we're supposed to make all preparations to ensure that, when ordered to by semaphore, the fleet can sail, and I quote, at the earliest practicable moment.
Which obviously means as soon as we get the order to put to sea. I am assuming that's why they want us to prepare to go to sea, you know.
But that isn't what they said, Jarrus smiled thinly. If that's what they meant, they should have said to sail immediately upon receipt of the order. That's non-discretionary. Practicable means I'm supposed to sail as soon as I can successfully get to sea and carry out my assigned mission. Which is going to be just a bit difficult, given that it looks very much as if the Carizians have massed at least 50 or 60 of their own galleons, bigger, faster, more heavily armed galleons, specifically to intercept us as we try to clear the Howard Passage. And just to make bad worse, the wind's in their favor, and it'll probably stay in their favor, 3 days out of 5 for the foreseeable future. He shook his head. If I tried to tack out of the Gulf of Jarrus into the broadsides of that many galleons, they'll pound my ships into driftwood before I ever clear the passage, much less make it to the Taro Channel, which isn't exactly the definition of practicable, according to any dictionary with which I'm familiar. Coleman tipped back in his chair, frowning. He rather doubted Elaine Maguire and Jaspar Clinton were likely to share his cousin-in-law's interpretation of the order they'd meant to give him. Despite that, Jarrus obviously had a point about what would happen if he took his own inexperienced ships into the teeth of that much highly experienced firepower. And even a confirmed landsman like Coleman could see the Baron was also right about the added, deadly disadvantage of the wind. The Howard Passage was less than 60 miles across. After allowing for various banks and shoals, it was actually considerably narrower than that. And at the moment, the wind was blowing almost directly into it, off the Gulf of Matthias.
"They aren't going to like hearing that," he said mildly, and Jarrus shrugged.
"They also haven't sent us the execute order yet," he pointed out. "In fact, our instructions are very clear on that point. We're supposed to prepare to sail, but wait until they tell us Harper and Shao are far enough along, then sortie. It's always possible Harper will never get close enough for them to issue that order. And if they do, and it's clearly not practicable for us to obey it, we can tell them that then. If they want to amend our orders and tell me to sail at any cost, obviously I will. But not until they get a message back to us, telling me they're prepared for us to sustain the sort of losses I'll take trying to obey. Which, even with the semaphore, will take a 5 day or so."
Coleman considered that as well. Then he shook his head.
"I don't disagree with you about how unwise it would be to sortie into that kind of opposition.
And this is clearly the sort of situation where the exercise of a certain discretion by the officers actually on the ground seems indicated. But the temples declared holy war. That kind of letter of my orders argument may not work for the Grand Inquisitor, especially if it comes at him cold.
I'm not a lunatic, Diven, and I don't want Vicar Jaspar pissed off at me any more than the next man.
Jarrus's voice and expression alike were grimmer than they had been.
At the same time, I'm not going to lead our navy into a sausage grinder when I know damned well what's going to happen to it.
I don't think you should. I just said this better not come at the temple cold. I think we should send them a report on the current situation. We need to formally acknowledge our receipt of their instructions anyway. So we tell them we're storing the ships, rounding up as many of the men we still need as we can lay hands on, and generally preparing to sortie, as soon as practicable, when they order us to. But we also tell them we've got somewhere around 2/3 of the entire damned Imperial Carizian Navy offshore. Then, if they send us the execute order, and if the weather's still against us, and the Carizians haven't reduced their strength, we send them another message that says that in light of the Carizian numbers, which we had previously reported, coupled with unfavorable wind conditions, we believe the sortie isn't practicable without our suffering losses severe enough to prevent us from carrying out our end of the mission.
It was Jarrus's turn to frown thoughtfully. It was always possible, even probable, the message Coleman was proposing to send would pass the actual execution order in transit. It might not, too, given how long it would take the northern force of galleons to approach the Gulf of Matthias. In either case, though, preparing the ground ahead of time offered obvious advantages.
And the truth is, he reflected, with this damned many Carizians mucking around in the Gulf of Matthias, we've already drawn off a huge chunk of their available strength. As Diven says, this has to be 2/3 of their total galleon strength. If Harper and Shaw can't break through Caleb's remaining 30 or so ships with over 100 of their own, we're all totally and completely screwed anyway.
I'd say you're on the right track, he said out loud. The one thing I think we should add, though, is to point out how large a percentage of the Carizian strength we've drawn into our own waters. It might not hurt to plant a seed or two of our own by suggesting that what we have here is the opportunity to trap the Carizians between the anvil of our coast and Harper and Shaw's hammer.
Now that, Irwin, strikes me as a very good notion, Coleman said approvingly. In that case, it would make perfect sense for us to sit tight, continuing to keep them drawn into our waters until Harper and Shaw can hit them from the other side, wouldn't it? They may actually go ahead and change our orders to do exactly that, in light of the Carizians' change in deployment.
I certainly won't object if they do, Jarrus agreed. And not just because it's a lot less likely to get my crews slaughtered, he added silently. Because the fact is, you're right, that would be the most effective blow we could strike out of this whole over-elaborate operation of Magwares.
All right, Master Lathic,
Sir Duncan Yearly told Destiny's first lieutenant as the sun settled into a glowing bed of red and purple embers on the western horizon.
I think it's time to stand a bit farther offshore before we snug everyone down for the night. We'll bring the column to a north by northwest heading, if you please.
Aye, aye, sir.
Robert Lathic replied, and gestured to the signal's midshipman to pass the order to the other ships. Yearly left him to it, walking aft to stand at the taffrail, watching the galleons astern of Destiny, while Lathic's orders sent the signal flags soaring up the halyards. He hoped the other ships were already prepared for the course change, which had been due about now under his standing orders. Sail drill was actually what most worried him about his entire mission, since it was what seemed most likely to alert the enemy to the truth.
Those other galleons simply didn't have the sort of manpower Destiny did, which was going to make it more difficult for them to carry out sailing evolutions with the sort of snap, precision, and speed that were hallmarks of a Carizian man of war. Not too surprisingly, Yerli supposed, since Destiny and her sister Mountain Root were the only two real men of war in that entire long column.
"We must have used up every can of black, white, and red paint in the entire city of Telesburg," he thought now, shaking his head as he watched evening settle in. "Who would have thought we could disguise an entire fleet of merchantmen just by slapping paint on their sides? Now all I have to do is make sure no one from Desner gets close enough to smell the fresh turpentine."
3. HMS Armok 58, Markovian Sea. High Admiral Brian Locke Island stood pondering the chart on his table. Brilliant sunshine reflections danced across the cabin's beams and deckhead, bouncing in through HMS Armok's stern windows. They glittered and flashed in the hearts of the crystal paperweights, anchoring the chart's corners, and his brass dividers gleamed like tarnished gold where they lay across the heart of the Markovian Sea. Armok's estimated position was indicated on that chart, 800 miles northeast of Hammer Island and 360 miles southwest of Salikar's Point. In actual fact, as Locke Island knew, that estimated position was almost exactly correct. And as he also knew, courtesy of Owl, the reports from his schooners 30 miles farther north were also accurate, if somewhat incomplete. He leaned forward, bracing himself on the table, trapping his position and the enemy's between the index fingers and thumbs of his two hands.
"Right about where you expected them," he thought. "Well, actually, be honest, you didn't really expect them to come this close to keeping their schedule, did you?"
He pursed his lips, considering what he knew of the opposing commanders. He knew quite a lot, actually, given Owl's remotes. The commanding officer of the Temple Lands-built contingent and the overall commander of the entire force was Bishop Cornelis Harper of the Order of Chihiro, who'd been named Admiral General of the Church's Navy. Of course, the Church had never had a navy before, and Harper had no experience commanding warships. He did, however, have extensive peacetime experience in the Temple Guard, and despite his silver hair, he was also relatively young, little more than 50, and vigorous. Smart, too, from everything Locke Island had been able to see. That was unfortunate. And so was the fact that he was obviously a Temple hardliner. Fortunately, no one in the Temple had any idea of the sort of staff arrangements towards which Earl Thirsk was working, but the men responsible for planning the organization of the newly christened Navy of God clearly possessed working brains. They divided their galleon strength into six-ship squadrons, each under the command of a senior prelate with guard experience, and then assigned each Admiral Bishop a flag captain from the Church's Coast Guard, Customs, and Courier Service. That experience wasn't remotely the same as commanding a warship in action, but it meant each of the bishops at least had an advisor with an understanding of the limitations on a ship's maneuverability. Bishop Cornelis's flag captain was Father Arnold Tybald, the Schulerite upper priest who commanded NGS Sword of God, Harper's flagship. He was 10 years younger than his admiral, and even more energetic. Dark-haired and dark-eyed, he was anything but a fool, and he'd spent close to 20 years in the Church's Coast Guard. The two of them got along well, another unfortunate thing from Locke Island's perspective. And even worse, Tybald knew Harper was not only willing to listen to his advice, but expected him to volunteer it.
"They're going to make mistakes," Locke Island mused, "but they won't be stupid mistakes. Not like the ones Malachi made at Rock Point. No, they'll be inexperienced mistakes. The sort smart people make when they have to do something they're not really trained to do. I'm going to have to keep that in mind."
The Harchong contingent, on the other hand, had a far more satisfactory command structure. Lock Island found the Imperial Harchongese Navy's rank titles a little ridiculous, but that was probably to be expected from a force that was, technically, the largest navy in the world, yet kept fewer ships in commission than Coruscant alone. Of course, they'd always maintained an officer corps big enough to command all of the ships they didn't have in commission as well. Worse, once a man earned the equivalent of captain's rank, all promotion in the IHN was based solely on seniority. As a consequence, the senior officer afloat was one Chintai Shao, the Duke of Sun Rising, who rejoiced in the title of Admiral of the Broad Oceans. A cousin of Emperor Waisu, he'd served, officially, in the IHN since 2 years before his actual birth. That, coupled with the appropriate bribes and the inherent corruption of all things Harchongese, had gotten him commissioned a captain of Winds the month he turned 16. Of course, he'd never actually set foot on a naval vessel until he was 21, but that sort of subterfuge was standard in Harchong, probably because it was the only way for anyone to attain flag rank when he was still at least theoretically young and vigorous enough to do some good. Admiral of the Broad Ocean Sun Rising flew his streamer in IHNS Flower of Waters. He was currently 75 years old, his health was poor, and he tended to go off on long rambling discourses at captains' conferences. No one would have dared say anything of the sort, not in Harchong, yet Lock Island knew at least some of Sun Rising's subordinates realized he was the wrong man in the wrong place. Unfortunately for them, he probably came the closest to being the right man of anyone of the appropriate seniority. Besides, his towering birth made him the only possible candidate for such a prestigious and important command. Captain of Winds Shukan Kausen, who commanded Sun Rising's flagship, was rather a different sort. Obviously, he had to be oppressively well-born to hold his current command, and although his own title was simply that of the Count of Wind Mountain, he was also the second son of the Duke of Dancing Water. And the Duke of Dancing Water, like every other Harchongese duke, was one of the Emperor's cousins. That was about the sole point of similarity between Wind Mountain and Sun Rising, however. The Captain of Winds was 20 years younger than the Admiral of the Broad Oceans, and there was nothing wrong with his brain. He had far less experience than a Carizian officer chosen for his position would have had, but he was more experienced than just about anyone else the IHN might have chosen. Fortunately, his father and Sun Rising detested one another, which meant his relations with his admiral weren't remotely like the mutual respect which flourished between Harper and Tybalt. Icily correct was probably the best way to describe them, which suited Brian Lock Island just fine.
"What was it that fellow Merlin was talking about the other day said?"
Lock Island frowned, trying to remember the man's name.
"Napoleon?"
Something like that, anyway. The High Admiral's frown turned into a grimace at his inability to remember the name. Yet, as he pondered the other side's command arrangements, he understood exactly what whatever his name was had meant when he called another general fortunate because he only had to fight coalitions.
"Any coalition's only as good as its coordination," he thought. "And until the group of four have been smacked around enough, I don't think they're likely to do the kind of arse-kicking necessary to make something like the Harchongese Navy coordinate with anybody. For that matter, I don't know if anyone short of God or a genuine archangel could kick that kind of aristocratic arse."
The thought was comforting, but only until he remembered that only 19 of the 93 armed galleons coming his way were Harchongese. The other 74 had all been built, armed, and manned by the Temple Lands. That was another kraken entirely, and not just because of the difference in the officers' corps involved either. The Temple Lands had officially abolished serfdom decades ago. Despite that, there were still serfs on virtually every major Temple Lands estate. They just weren't called that. By the same token, there were still men in Emerald and even Chisholm who were called serfs, but who'd actually become small landowners in their own rights. In fact, the phased abolition of the legal status of serf, a firm requirement of the Carisian Empire, had raised scarcely a ripple in Emerald or Chisholm. Within another 2 years, the process would be completed. The situation was a little more complicated in Coruscant, and especially Zebediah, where the conditions of serfdom had varied widely between one feudal territory and another. There'd been no serfs at all in Manchir, Tartarian, or Aerith, for example, and the institution had been very similar to the Chisomian variety in Rocaire, Chorus, Barcaire, and Anvil Rock, and on Winddaughter Island. It probably wasn't a coincidence that almost all the knights who joined the Northern Conspiracy in Coruscant practiced a rather more severe version of serfdom, on the other hand, and phasing it out in Coruscant was going to take longer. But they not only had serfs in Harchong, they had outright slaves, lots of them. Whereas Karis, and Emerald, Chisholm, and Coruscant in varying degrees, had a bustling, vibrant free labor force, supporting a steadily growing middle class, as well as wealthy entrepreneurs like Edward Houseman, Harchong had vast slave-worked plantations, and the workforce in Harchongese manufactories was almost always composed of slave laborers as well. There was no Harchongese middle class, no free labor force, and definitely no equivalent of the Carisian treasure chest of experienced seamen. Harchongese warships were crewed by men who'd literally been driven aboard with the lash in many cases, and who were controlled by a brutal, often capricious discipline, which would have provoked an almost instant mutiny aboard any Carisian vessel. And not surprisingly, their crews gave them exactly the degree of loyalty and initiative they deserved. There might be a modicum of enthusiasm, or at least willingness, aboard the IHN's ships now that the Group of Four had declared holy war. The deep reservoir of faith among the Harchongese peasantry and serfs was one of the things which held the empire together, and the priests aboard those ships had appealed fervently to that faith. Yet dumb acceptance of brutal conditions, even born of religious fervor, was no substitute for the enthusiasm and high morale which routinely prevailed aboard Carisian warships. The Navy of God had its own share of conscripted serfs, but unlike its Harchongese counterpart, they formed a definite minority within its crews. Not only that, but each had been promised relief from the legal obligation which bound him to the land, and they were actually being paid the same wage as their non-serf crewmates. They were even eligible for promotion to petty officer status. That would have been a big enough difference all by itself, but the majority of the Navy of God's crews were composed of freemen. Many came from the same sort of class backgrounds as their Carisian counterparts, although only a handful of them had been seafarers before their enlistment. The church's dominant position within the Temple Lands economy also meant a great many of them, probably even the majority, had personal, direct connections to the church or one of its myriad business enterprises, which gave them a direct, personal stake in the church's secular future. The reservoirs of faith in the Temple Lands were probably just as deep as those in the Harchong Empire as well, although it had less of the dumb, patient, almost bovine acceptance of the Harchongese serfs. Which meant that although they were nowhere nearly so experienced or well-trained as the ICN, and although it was obvious that most of them were more than a little anxious, even frightened, at the prospect of meeting Carisians in battle, they were highly motivated, well integrated, and tightly knit, and Harper and his subordinate admirals had them training hard. Their sail drill had improved markedly in the 5 days since they'd departed Chantry Bay, and Harper had ordered every ship to spend a minimum of 2 hours a day at gun drill as well. The Harchongi's ships were supposed to be doing the same thing, and some of them actually were, although their results were problematical. The Navy of God, on the other hand, was improving steadily. There was no way of knowing how well their training would stand up once round shot started tearing their ships apart around them, yet even by Lock Island's most optimistic assessment, each Temple Lands built ship had to be worth at least 3, probably 4, Harchongi's galleons of the same armament. And 80% of the armed vessels coming at him had Temple Lands crews and Navy of God officers.
What a truly not good situation, he thought, reflecting on the grand and glorious total of his own 13 galleons. Outnumbered by close to 6 to 1, and the rotten cheating bastards have had the unmitigated gall to actually train their crews. What a revolting development!
A faint smile twitched his lips, but it faded quickly, and he straightened. He walked to the stern windows and stood gazing out them, thinking. The good news, such as it was that Harper and Tybalt had no counterweight for his own reconnaissance capabilities. Like Caleb before Rock Point and Darko Sound, he had plenty of scouting cruisers scattered out to keep an eye on his enemies. But, also like Caleb before Rock Point and Darko Sound, their true function was to explain how he could have the information Owl Snarks had already provided. As a consequence, he knew precisely where his enemies were and what they were doing, and they didn't know that about him.
That ought to be enough to let me pick my own time to engage, he thought, unseeing eyes staring out at the waves of the Markovian Sea. Let me pick the time, the weather conditions, make sure I've got the weather gauge. All of that's going to be a huge advantage. But once we get in amongst them, once it's broadside to broadside, and all any of my captains will know is that he can see through the gun smoke with his own eyes, all those advantages disappear. Then it's experience and numbers and guts and gunpowder. And right this minute, the only one of those where I really have an edge over Harper is experience, which is not going to be enough.
His head turned, tracking around, almost as if he actually thought his own unaided eyes could see across the endless miles of salt water to Old Karas, and his mouth tightened.
Get your arse here in time, Dominic, he thought, almost prayerfully. Get your arse up here while there's still time to do some good.
He drew a deep breath and turned away from the windows. It was time he went on deck and saw what he could do to slow the enemy down, long enough for Dominic Stainer to answer his prayer. 4. HMS Destroyer, 54. Larrick, Howell Bay, Kingdom of Old Karas. Sir Dominic Stainer had no way of knowing what Brian Lock Island was thinking at that particular moment, but he knew what Lock Island ought to be thinking. He paused in his pacing, standing by the starboard quarterdeck hammock nettings, and gazed out across the port city of Larrick. It was an interesting city, Larrick. 5 years ago, it had been little more than a sleepy fishing village. The navigable Delphac River had linked it to Ithman's Lake in the Earldom of High Rock, but that had meant little until Edward Hausman broke ground for his foundry complex at Delphac on the lake's northwestern shore. When Merlin Athrawas first arrived in Karas, there'd been nothing there but the tiny town, a hamlet really, with no more than 50 or 60 inhabitants, which had given its name to the river. Today, Delphac was the largest foundry operation in the history of Safehold. The output from Hausman's complex of manufactories alone was greater than that of the iron industry of the entire Harchong Empire. The consequences for Larrick had been significant. The one-time fishing village might well have become the only port in the world which was actually busier than Telesburg. It was smaller, with a smaller total number of ships coming and going, but it never slept, and there was never ever enough room dockside for all the ships trying to land or take on cargo. It helped some that even seagoing ships could sail up the Delphac if they were careful, although many captains considered it more prudent to let river barges handle that part of the transportation loop. Rockpoint had been tempted to take his ships upriver, but not very strongly. Under other circumstances, he might have been willing to take the chance. Not this time, though. His galleons drew more water than the majority of ships that plied the river, and he couldn't afford, literally could not afford, to ground one of his 12 priceless warships. They were going to be far too desperately needed, far too soon, for him to risk stranding one of them on a sandbar or a rock. Which was why he had to lie at anchor, pacing his quarterdeck, watching through the snarks, as Brian Lock Island began the delicate, dangerous task of buzzing around Cornelis Harper's ears. He knew what Lock Island was supposed to do: distract Harper, annoy him, make him anxious about protecting the unarmed galleons he was escorting to Desnair. It was Lock Island's job to slow Harper down any way he could, and it was Rockpoint's job to sit here, waiting, while Edward Hausman worked frantically to produce the explosive shells which might give the Imperial Carizian Navy a chance to actually stop the enemy. Personally, Rockpoint gave them a slightly better-than-even chance, assuming Hausman was able to produce enough shells, and that he was able to get them to Lock Island's assistance in time. There was, however, a significant difference between inflicting enough damage to cripple Harper's fleet and surviving the experience.
"Even with the shells, we're going to have to come in close," he thought once more. "If we can reach them, then they can reach us, and they'll have one hell of a lot more guns than we will. If the shells surprise them badly enough, if they break, if they aren't willing to come to close action with us, then maybe..." He inhaled deeply. "Either we do it or we don't, but there are times I wish I had the same depth of faith Michael does. It's not that I don't believe in you anymore, God. It's just that looking at what you've allowed to happen here on Safehold so far, I have to wonder what else you're ready to allow. Michael's all right with that, with the acceptance of your will, whatever it is. I try to be the same way, but I can't. Or maybe I can, where I'm concerned at least. It's just that your will can be so hard sometimes. Like what happened to Gwillem, what happened to Samuel Wilson and his circle, Father Timon and Coruscant."
He closed his eyes for a long moment, standing motionless. And then he gave himself a shake, opened his eyes once more, and actually smiled crookedly.
"All right," he thought. "I know. Free will. Michael's explained it to me often enough, and I guess it makes sense. I've done my damnedest to figure out what it is you want me to do, too, and I think I've got it. I hope I do, anyway, and I promise I'll give it my best shot. But please, if you could, keep an eye on us. We need you more now than we've ever needed you before. I may be too busy to tell you that, or to think about you the way I ought to when the balls begin to fly, but don't you forget about us, and especially not about my men. I may not be Michael, but I'm ready to accept whatever it is you have in mind for me. Only look after my men, please, God, whoever you really are, whatever it is you really want of us, of me. Look after my men."
November, Year of God, 894. 1. NGS Sword of God, 50, off the Windmore Coast, Gulf of Taro.
"I'm finding it difficult of late to remember that God and Langhorne send all good things in their own time,"
Cornelis Harper remarked as he reached for his hot chocolate. He looked across the table at his flag captain and smiled crookedly.
"Or perhaps I should actually say I'm finding it difficult to possess my soul in patience until Langhorne tumbles the minions of Shanwei into the pit prepared for them."
The minions in question do seem to be exceptionally pestiferous, don't they, my lord?
Father Arnald agreed.
I think that's what makes it so difficult to remember that to all things there comes a season.
And I suppose this is the season for provoking my ulcers.
Harper shook his head, then sipped chocolate. Arnald Tybald snorted and began spreading butter on another biscuit. Stowed down in the coolness of the flagship's bilge, the butter had kept remarkably well so far. It was finally beginning to turn rancid. It always did. But it was still more palatable than dry biscuit, especially with a little jam, and at least the hens and wyverns were both still producing fresh eggs. Harper had already finished his own eggs and bacon, and he pushed back his chair. Tybald began to rise himself, but the Admiral General waved him back.
"Finish breakfast, Arnald," he scolded. "Not even a batch of Shanwei damned heretics is going to come calling on us in the next 15 minutes.
"Of course, my lord. Thank you."
Tybald would actually have preferred to go ahead and stand, if Harper was going to. It seemed disrespectful not to, but he knew it would irritate the Admiral General. For that matter, Harper would scold him again if he seemed to be bolting his food to get finished quickly. So he made himself chew slowly and methodically, while Harper stepped out onto Sword of God's sternwalk. The flagship sailed steadily on a roughly southwesterly heading, with the wind on her larboard quarter under topsails and topgallants. She was doing well to make 4 knots under that little canvas, given the current wind conditions, and Harper would really have preferred to make more sail. Unfortunately, Duke Sunrising's ship's seamanship didn't seem to be quite as good as his own.
"Not surprisingly," the Admiral General thought grumpily, "I'm glad the Duke is so eager to coordinate with us, and I'm awed by his, or his secretary's at least, command of the language. Still, I probably could survive without those incredibly flowery letters if he'd just actually institute the sail drill I asked for."
He carefully did not apply to the Harchongi's fleet commander a term bishops weren't supposed to use to describe faithful sons of Mother Church. Under the circumstances, it required more self-discipline than usual.
"Maybe I should have let Arnald deal with it. Let him talk to Wind Mountain, one flag captain to another flag captain. Maybe we could have finessed it past Sunrising that way. Of course, given the fact that Sunrising hates Wind Mountain's father's guts, that might have worked out even worse. Or as badly, at least. I don't really think it could have worked out worse. Unless Sunrising could have figured out how to actually undo the drill they have carried out."
His lips twitched, although the thought really wasn't all that humorous. It was entirely possible Sunrising could have figured out a way to do that. If anyone on Safehold was capable of such a feat, it would have to be the Duke. The Admiral General wrapped both hands around the chocolate cup. The sun was bright, and he'd been delighted to leave the bitter cold behind. The Icewind Sea had been bad enough in October. The passage of storms and the Markovian Sea had been still worse in their own ways, even if they had been marginally warmer. The passage of storms, especially, had done everything possible to live up to its name. In fact, his face tightened, he'd lost 2 ships to one of the furious gales which had swept over his fleet. That storm had scattered his formation badly, too. If the Carizians had happened upon him then, with his ships spread out all over the ocean, Langhorne only knew what they might have done to him. But they were nearing the equator now, and the Gulf of Taro was a far more pleasant experience in November than the Markovian Sea in October. It was still cool this early in the morning, but by late afternoon he'd be wishing he could have hung on to the morning chill, especially if the wind didn't strengthen. He gazed into the east wind, eyes slightly squinted against the still low-lying sun. There'd been a distinctly reddish cast to the dawn, and a smear of cloud seemed to be swelling up along the horizon.
"Red sonnet morning, sailor take warning," he quoted to himself. "The writ warns against self-prideful predictions. I wonder if I could have been a bit hasty, congratulating myself on having left the heavy weather behind."
He sipped chocolate, then looked up as the cries of gulls and shrill whistles of wyverns came down from above. The winged creatures swarmed out from the coast of the Republic of Sidarmark's Windmore province, and as he watched, one of the wyverns swooped down to snatch something from the sea. He couldn't tell whether it was a fish or a bit of garbage scooped out of Sword of God's wake, but he found himself wishing the wyvern well, whatever it had found.
"I see the Admiral of the Broad Oceans is still with us, my lord," a voice said, and Harper turned to find Tybald had joined him on the sternwalk.
Like the Admiral General, the flag captain had brought along his chocolate cup. Now he leaned his hip against the sternwalk's rail and nodded in the direction of a particularly untidy gaggle of sails trailing along to the north-northwest.
"More or less," Harper agreed, yet he also gave Tybald a moderately quelling look.
The title the upper priest had just bestowed upon Duke Sunrising was absolutely correct, but the Admiral General knew the flag captain had not used its grandiloquent entirety as a compliment. Harper couldn't fault Tybald's opinion, but certain appearances had to be maintained, and the flag captain half-dipped his head, acknowledging the unspoken rebuke.
"Actually," the Admiral General went on, "they do seem to be keeping somewhat better station this morning, don't they?"
"It may have something to do with those schooners yesterday, my lord," Tybald said dryly, and Harper snorted.
The humor in that snort was minimal. He'd found himself wishing more than once. In fact, he doubted there'd been a single half hour during this entire miserable, interminable trek in which he hadn't wished that Captain General Maguire had decided against lumbering him with his Harchongese allies. Their miserable seamanship, lack of discipline, and prickly self-importance would have made them a questionable asset at the best of times. The fact that the majority of their ships were completely or almost completely unarmed only made bad worse. Even one of the Carizian schooners could strike at an unarmed galleon with impunity, and the handful of armed, wretchedly handled Harchongese galleons were woefully inadequate to fend them off, which was why Harper had been forced to detach an entire squadron of his own galleons to do the job for them.
"Maybe we can convince Sunrising to sell his ships to Desnair after we reach Ithria," he wondered wistfully. "Jarus isn't exactly a brilliant master of the seaways, but he's got to be better than the Harchongese, and the whole idea was to get Desnairian guns put aboard them because their own foundries weren't up to the task. Surely I can convince Vicar Elaine we ought to put Desnairian crews aboard to make sure the guns actually get used eventually."
"I wonder when the Carizians are going to stop dancing and actually attack, my lord," Tybald said in a considerably more somber tone.
He waved his chocolate cup to windward, where a trio of those omnipresent, maddeningly maneuverable Carizian schooners paced Harper's formation.
"I admit it's irritating when the schooners dart in, but Caleb can't really think they're going to do any sort of significant damage."
"Not as long as our formation holds," Harper agreed. "But remember what it was like in the Passage of Storms. If those schooners had turned up then..."
He let his voice trail off and shrugged, and Tybald nodded.
"I understand what you're saying, my lord, but unless another gale makes up, which it could in these waters at this time of year, it's unlikely we'll get scattered again. Caleb's too smart to be counting on something like that, and he's running out of time. Once we get through the Taro Channel and Jarus sorties to meet us, it'll be too late. Unless he wants to wade into all of us, at any rate."
It was Harper's turn to nod. He and Tybald had discussed this very point often enough, and he knew the flag captain was right. If Caleb of Carus didn't strike soon, he'd lose the opportunity completely.
Well, according to our latest dispatches, he's still blockading the Howard Passage, the Admiral General pointed out now. I know anything from Jarrus is at least 2 or 3 5 days out of date by the time it gets to us, semaphore or no semaphore, but even allowing for that, the majority of Caleb's strength still has to be south of us. Harper grimaced. I suppose it's possible he really is going to let us catch him between us and the Desnarian coast.
No, my lord, he's not, Tybald disagreed, respectfully but firmly. I'm astonished he's spent so long off Desnair already, but he'll never let us pin him against the coast. You're probably right that he's still south of us, but in that case, my money's on his sailing to meet us somewhere inside the Taro Channel itself. He's going to be badly outnumbered, whatever happens, and if Vicar Elaine's little sleight of hand worked, he may have diverted a sizable portion of his total strength to Chisholm and Coruscant. In that case, he's going to be outnumbered very badly, and he may figure engaging us in the channel would constrict our movements enough to offset some of that. But one way or the other, he'll hit us before we reach the Gulf of Matthias. Either that, or else he's going to realize we're too strong for him to challenge at sea, and concentrate on getting out of the way, and then defending his own harbors instead.
Harper raised one eyebrow, but he didn't dispute Tybald's analysis. First, because it made sense. But secondly, because Tybald had demonstrated to Harper's satisfaction that he had a superior grasp of both tactical and strategic implications. In many ways, the bishop felt Tybald would have made a better admiral general than he did. Unfortunately, the underpriest lacked the seniority for that assignment, and Harper considered himself extraordinarily lucky to have him for an advisor. And a teacher, really, the bishop admitted to himself.
Well, it was Harper's turn to indicate the watching schooners with a flick of his head. At least we can be pretty sure Caleb's going to know where to find us when he wants us.
2. HMS Armok 58, Gulf of Taro, and Imperial Palace, Chiraeth, Kingdom of Chisholm.
Where to find us when he wants us.
Brian Lock Island snorted as the parasite, perched on Admiral General Harper's shoulder, transmitted his conversation to him in real time.
Knowing where to find you's never been the problem, he muttered in the general direction of Harper's fleet, and heard someone else's snort, even harsher than his own, in his earplug.
True, Caleb Armok said from Prince Tymon's suite in snowy Chisholm. At the moment, he was the next best thing to 8,000 miles away from, and 10 hours behind, Lock Island's flagship.
I only wish it was me who knew where to find him, or get to him anyway, he added.
What?
Lock Island smiled thinly, out over another stretch of the blue water Harper was even then considering from his own flagship.
Should I take that to indicate a certain lack of confidence in the command team you do have on the spot, Your Majesty?
Of course not. Caleb chuckled at the humor in his cousin's voice, but his own tone turned considerably more serious. If I can't be there myself, I can't think of any two people I'd rather have standing in for me. It's just that I hate asking it of you and the men when I can't be there with you.
I understand, Lock Island said quietly, and he did.
Just as he understood that being able to watch everything happen, even as it did, was going to make things infinitely worse for his Emperor and Empress.
We'll be praying for you, Brian, Charlian said softly, as if she'd read his mind across all those weary miles of stormy salt water.
Thank you, Lock Island smiled again whimsically. It can't hurt, anyway.
Actually, I think it might help a great deal, Michael Stainer said from his office in his Telesburg Palace. Of course, it's my job to think that way, I suppose.
Lock Island could almost see the twinkle in the Archbishop's eye, and he shook his head. There was a curious parallelism with his adversary, he reflected. Both of them were standing on the sternwalks of their flagships, looking east, thinking and planning. Unlike Harper, however, Lock Island knew there were barely 50 miles of water between those two flagships. He knew exactly what his enemy's formation was, and he'd sat in invisibly when Harper and Tybald discussed the course they intended to steer. As the Admiral General said, he knew exactly where to find him and exactly what he'd face when he did.
"The one thing I don't know is what's going to happen when I do." "Show me the map, Owl," he requested.
"Yes, High Admiral," the AI said, and a chart of the Gulf of Taro and surrounding landmasses projected itself across Lock Island's contact lenses. It hadn't changed since the last time he'd checked, but he gazed thoughtfully at the icon representing Rockpoint's ships. They were coming up fast from the southeast under every stitch of canvas, and his eyebrows rose as he glanced at the information sidebars Owl updated continuously. Those had changed, at least a little, and he frowned as he contemplated the new data. The wind had strengthened more, or at least more rapidly, for Rockpoint's ships than originally projected. Owl's present estimate was that the 12 galleons would arrive almost 4 hours earlier than projected, and that meant...
"I wonder," the High Admiral murmured out loud.
"You wonder what?"
There was something remarkably like suspicion in Caleb's voice, and Lock Island smiled.
"Dominic's going to get here sooner than I'd anticipated," he replied. "And that weather front's moving in from the east more quickly than anticipated as well. If the current projections hold up, and if Dominic and I were to shift our rendezvous point a few miles, I think we might be able to come in right on the front's heels."
"That," Caleb said, in the tone of a man whose suspicions have just been confirmed, "sounds like a really bad idea. Sailing into the middle of a fleet that outnumbers you 4-1 in the middle of the night, in the rain, strikes me as a wonderful recipe for disaster."
"Odd," Rockpoint put in from his own flagship, still 200 miles from HMS Armagh. "If you and Gwilym had discussed your tactical notions with me before Crag Reach, that's exactly what I would have said then. Oh, except that I probably would have added that you were planning on sailing in through a narrow channel you couldn't even see in the middle of a full gale. Obviously, a far better and more maturely considered battle plan all around, Your Majesty."
"The situation was entirely different, and you know it," Caleb riposted. "Thirsk's fleet's morale was already broken, and I had a huge firepower advantage. Not only that, he was anchored. I had every maneuver advantage there was, and his people were more than half defeated before we ever fired the first shot. You may have noticed there's just a bit of difference between the Dolaran's condition then and what Harper and Tybald have accomplished with their ships."
"That's true," Lock Island acknowledged. "By the same token, though, Thirsk wasn't handicapped by having 50 unarmed Harchongi's galleons hanging on his coattails. Not only that, Harper's formation spread out between 6 columns, 7 counting the squadron he's got covering that gaggle of sunrisings. And I don't care how well he's managed to drill his crews, none of them will expect a night action. You know how confusing and terrifying that can be, Caleb. You counted on it at Crag Reach. And however much training they've done, our people are a lot more experienced, so any confusion's going to work a lot more in our favor than theirs."
"The only way you're going to stand a chance against that many enemy ships is to maintain tight tactical control," Caleb argued, his voice flat. "And every one of your signal systems depend on people being able to see them. If you lose cohesion, if your formation comes apart in the middle of all those church galleons, you lose, Brian. I don't care how good our people are. I'll even concede that you'll give better than you get, but in the end, you'll lose."
"If he manages to maintain his tactical control, we lose anyway, because we won't be able to get deep enough to break him up," Lock Island replied.
We can nibble around the edges, but we can't stop him without ripping the brain and the heart out of his fleet, and you know it. For that, we have to penetrate his formation.
And there's another point, Caleb, Rock Island said. Edward only had time to manufacture a couple thousand shells, and the gun crews haven't had the time or the spare ammunition to train with them.
The Baron shrugged where he sat in his day cabin's comfortable armchair.
We've dry-fired and rehearsed, but they've never actually used them, and despite the Navy's confidence in Alfred, they're going to be a little tentative at first. We're going to have to get in really close to make them count, and I've only got about 170 in each ship. That's less than 8 broadsides for each of them. So if we can't make each of those broadsides count, we lose. And if we have to spar around the fringes, fight our way through just to get to decisive range in the first place, we may lose one or more of the shell-armed ships on our way in. Worse, we may have to use shell fire to get inside in the first place, in which case the people we're really after may have time to figure out what's coming before we hit them with it.
But, Caleb began.
They're right, Caleb, a deep voice said quietly. The Emperor's head turned, eyes sweeping towards the door beyond which Merlin Athrawis stood guard over Prince Tymon's suite.
They're right, the Sajan repeated, sub-vocalizing over his own built-in calm. They can't win this one by just killing ships. They can't kill enough of them. They have to defeat the fleet's cohesion, and to do that, they have to get in close. Worse, Harper's signal system may not be as good or as flexible as ours, but it's good enough for him to mass his squadrons if he's able to see Brian and Dominic coming. For that matter, there's going to be enough gun smoke once close action is joined, it would be almost impossible for Brian to pass signals reliably anyway. The fact that he and Dominic, at least, will be able to see exactly what's going on will offer a significant advantage over Harper, but they won't be able to give detailed orders to anyone else whatever happens. Better for them to go in the dark, when the other side can't exercise any sort of tight control, and the confusion lets us maximize our ship's individual superiority.
Caleb sat silent for several endless seconds, and his wife's hand reached out across the bassinet between them. She laid it on his knee, and he looked at her quickly.
"Let them do it their way," she said very softly. "They're the best you've got. They're the ones actually on the spot, and they deserve for you to have enough confidence in them to let them fight their battle the way they think best. I know it's not easy for you, and I know why, but let them do it their way."
Caleb inhaled deeply, and then, slowly, he nodded.
"All right, Brian, Dominic, we'll do it your way," the Emperor of Karis said quietly.
3. Off the Windmore Coast, Gulf of Taro. Arnald Tybald grimaced as a fresh wall of tropical rain swept across NGS Sword of God's poop deck. Rain in the Gulf of Taro wasn't like rain in more northern waters. It didn't start gradually. There was no gentle warning. A handful of enormous raindrops smacked into his already streaming oilskins, like cavalry hooves clattering down a stone street. Then, almost before his mind had time to register their impact, a solid wave of water pounded down. Visibility dropped instantly to almost nothing. Of course, visibility had already been limited at the moment, given the overcast night's total lack of moon or stars, but he could barely see the glow of the binnacle through the deluge, and when he looked up, he saw what looked like ground mist where splintered raindrops bounced back up off the deck planking.
"Me and my wise-ass comments about bad weather," he reflected.
Still, compared to the passage of storms, this wasn't bad weather. Not really. The wind had risen, enough for the fleet to furl its topgallants, but it came steadily out of the east, without rage or violence.
It had veered almost 2 full points, to broad on Sword of God's beam on her present heading, but the sea's motion hadn't caught up with the wind shift. The waves continued to come in under her quarter, imparting an uncomfortable corkscrew motion. There was no indication of squalls, no thunder, no lightning flashing on the horizon, however.
"Not even Sun Rising's fumble fists are going to have any trouble out of this kind of storm," he thought, then reached out and rapped his knuckles on the wooden fife rail. "Let's not tempt fate, Arnold," he reminded himself sardonically.
Brian Lock Island tucked both loaded double-barreled pistols into their holster loops under his oilskins, then returned the pistol case to his desk drawer. Keelhaul sat beside him, and the big dog whined softly, as if he could read his master's mind.
"Which he probably can, after this long," the High Admiral reflected.
He went down on one knee, putting an arm around the Rottweiler's massive neck. Then he straightened and slapped the enormous dog on the shoulder.
"Time to go below," he said out loud.
Keelhaul cocked his head, ears lifted, and whined again louder.
"No arguments," Lock Island said more sternly. "There's not a damn thing you can do up here. Now go with Henry."
Keelhaul gave him one more piteous look. Then the big dog's ears drooped, and he heaved unhappily to his feet and crossed slowly to Lieutenant Commander Tillier, toenails clicking on the deck planks, audible even above the sound of rain drumming on the cabin skylights. It wasn't really a lieutenant commander's job to take a pet below for safety, but Keelhaul and Tillier were old friends. The dog was a lot more likely to actually go, and even more importantly, to stay, if Tillier saw to his incarceration in the bosun's storeroom well below Armok's waterline. Given how hard it was to actually sink a wooden warship, that was one of the safest places in the entire ship, and Lock Island felt grateful it was so, as Keelhaul gave him one more reproachful, over-the-shoulder glance, sighed heavily, and followed Tillier out of the cabin.
"I trust the High Admiral won't take this wrongly, but it's always reassuring to see the way all about you leap instantly to obey your commands."
Lock Island turned, cocking his head at Silman Baker, his flag captain. Baker was small, compact, dark-haired and dark-eyed, and an elegant dresser. It was said, probably accurately, that he'd spent more than a master's mate's yearly salary on his dress uniform. He was also competent, smart, and as close to absolutely fearless as any man Lock Island had ever met. In fact, he reminded the High Admiral a great deal of a younger version of Regis Yowance.
"Well, I sure as hell hope he's all those good things," Lock Island thought with a mental snort. "The Navy's High Admiral isn't supposed to choose flag captains by picking names out of a hat."
"I'm glad you find it reassuring, Silman," he said. "And considering how many years you've known Keelhaul, I'm sure you understand that getting him to do anything he doesn't want to do is akin to carrying a 30-pounder from one end of the Telesburg waterfront to the other on your back, only harder." He grimaced. "Trust me, winning that particular battle of wills is going to make kicking Harper's arse look like a walk in the park."
"I'm glad to hear it, sir," Baker said with a smile.
"Good. In that case, I'm sure you won't mind clearing the ship for action, Captain."
"At once, sir," Baker replied, and saluted sharply.
Normally, the urgent tattoo of drums would have sent Armok's crew scurrying to action stations. Not tonight, however. Artificial sounds had an astonishing ability to carry preposterous distances across water. Wind and rain, the sound of waves, the hum of rigging could be depended upon to deaden much of that sound, but no one was much inclined to take unnecessary chances this night. And so, aboard every one of the 25 Carisian galleons forging through the Stygian darkness, no drum sounded as men were sent to their stations by quiet orders. Feet pattered across decks. Muffled thumps and bangs came from below as internal partitions were dismantled and sent down into the hold, along with furniture, paintings, officers' wine cabinets, flag officers' armchairs, cabin rugs. Gun trucks squeaked and rumbled as breech ropes were cast off, and the massive carriages were trundled back from where they normally stood, nestled firmly against the side of the hull and lashed there. Lead aprons were removed from touchholes. Gun locks were fitted. Tompions were removed from muzzles. Rammers and worms came down from overhead racks. Tubs of water were arranged between each pair of guns. Buckets of sand were scattered over the decking to provide traction and absorb blood. Forward, the gunner issued cutlasses and boarding pikes. The newfangled pistols, which had been invented for the Imperial Guard, had become much more common. And now, simpler, smoothbore versions were issued to senior petty officers and seamen. Wolves, the light, swivel-mounted anti-personnel weapons of choice, were issued and hauled up to the fighting tops. Carronade gunners swarmed along the upper deck, preparing their own weapons while rain bounced from the stubby barrels like freshwater spray. Until the upper deck guns heated up, the flintlock's reliability would be suspect, so lengths of old-fashioned slow match were wrapped around linstocks and placed in canvas-screened tubs, where the betraying glow would be sheltered from hostile eyes and extinguishing rain alike. Above the decks, more hands spread protective nets to catch falling blocks and severed cordage. Other seamen rigged chain slings to support the yards. Boats which were normally stowed amidships were hoisted out, put over the side to tow astern, where they could generate no lethal splinters if they were struck by enemy shot. Below decks, surgeons laid out knives and saws, healers laid out Fleming moss and bandages, and sick berth attendants scrubbed down the mess tables where wounded men would all too soon lie sobbing in agony. The Carisian standard was to clear for action from a standing start, without warning, in no more than 15 minutes. Tonight it took twice that long, because there was time. Time to do it right. Time to make preparations without risking accident and injury. Time to double-check every single aspect of the process. There was not a man aboard the flagship, or aboard any of the ships following in Armok's wake, who didn't understand exactly what they faced, who hadn't been told the odds, who couldn't compute the chances of their own survival, or grasp what would happen if the ships invisible to them through darkness and rain were allowed to unite with the Desnarian fleet in the Gulf of Jaros. They were experienced, most of those men. They knew the Carisian tradition. They didn't think, didn't merely believe, that they were the finest sea fighters in the history of the world. They knew they were, just as they knew what the Church of God Awaiting and the Inquisition would do to their homes and their families if they lost this war. Brian Locke Island stood on his quarterdeck, feeling rain beat on his own oilskins, watching the projected map only he could see, and felt that in his men, felt their knowledge, their fear, their determination.
"Be sure your mind is fresh enough to make the decisions worthy of the men under your command," Dominic Stainer had said to Caleb Armok on another rainy night, before the Battle of Rock Point. Caleb had told his cousin about it, and now Locke Island repeated that same sentence to himself.
"Sir, the ship is cleared for action," Silman Baker told him, touching the chest of his streaming oilskins in salute.
"Very well, Captain," the High Admiral said. "Be good enough to make the signal."
"Sir, the flags hoisted the signal."
Captain Zachary Waste turned from a quiet conversation with the ship's chaplain at the signal midshipman of the watch's excited announcement.
"Has it indeed, Master Holman?"
His tone was calculated to steady the lad, and the midshipman drew a deep breath.
"Yes, sir,"
he said in a much calmer voice, and Waste nodded. The captain's eyes were no longer young, but he doubted that would have made a great deal of difference. The downpour was so heavy, he could barely see as far forward as the mainmast. He might have been able to pick out a faint glow, diffused across the plunging raindrops from Armok's big stern lanterns, shaded to be invisible from anywhere but astern, yet he wouldn't have bet money on it. And he for damn sure couldn't see the three red lanterns hoisted to the flagship's mizzen yard. But young Hallman was a reliable lad, and Waste was prepared to take his word for it.
"Have you acknowledged, Master Hallman?"
"Aye, sir. One red lantern at the fore topsail yard."
"Very well, then. Repeat the signal to our next astern, if you please."
"Aye, aye, sir."
One by one, down the entire length of that rain-lashed line of galleons, the red lanterns rose. Their gleam was all but lost in the darkness and rain, but sharp-eyed lookouts had been awaiting them for hours. Ship by ship, they were sighted and acknowledged. It took time, a seeming eternity, as Brian Lock Island waited on his quarter-deck at the head of that long column, but eventually Baker's signal lieutenant saluted.
"Darko Sound has hauled down her lantern, High Admiral."
"Good,"
Lock Island said calmly. Zachary Waste could be something of a fuss budget, and there was no denying he had a pompous streak at least 2 feet wide, but he was as steady and reliable as a rock, and the man who could frighten him had yet to be born. That was why he commanded Darko Sound, the second ship in Lock Island's line. The lowering of the lantern from Darko Sound's fore topsail yardarm was the signal that Waste's own next astern, HMS Daffodil, had just lowered her forward lantern. There'd been simpler and faster ways to pass that information. Indeed, both Armok and Rockpoint's flagship, Destroyer, were equipped to use those other ways when the time came, but not yet. They were too energetic, too indiscreet. Still, Darko Sound's lowered lantern showed everyone astern of her had done the same thing, indicating receipt of Armok's signal to prepare for battle. As it happened, Lock Island knew that. He'd watched through the remotes Al had deployed to smother the area.
"This must have been driving Merlin crazy ever since he got here," the High Admiral thought now. "He's been able to see so much, know so much, almost instantly, and he still had to rely on signal flags and lanterns and the speed of mounted couriers because no one else could see it. And, of course, because he couldn't afford for his abilities to be labeled demonic." "In that case, Captain Baker," he said out loud, turning once more to face his flag captain in the pounding rain, "I believe it's time we were about it.